A rare form of cancer has struck at least 26 gay men in New York and California in the past 30 months, resulting in 9 reported deaths. The cancer, called Kaposi sarcoma, is characterized by blue and purple skin lesions and has no known cure. Teams of doctors at the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta and the University of California Medical Center in San Francisco fear the disease may reach epidemic proportions in the gay male community.
So little in the summer of 1981, when news of a mysterious cancer outbreak was first reported in the gay media. We had no idea that behind this cancer was a breakdown of the body's immune system, and no way of seeing how drastically it would affect our lives in the coming years. In 1981, it didn't even have a name. Today, 2 years later, 1,600 people have contracted this disease, 600 are dead. 3/4 of these are gay men. And today, we have a name for this disease, AIDS, the Acquired Immune Deficiency Syndrome. Gays are not the only ones who have been hit by the AIDS epidemic. It has afflicted women, children, Haitian immigrants, intravenous drug users, hemophiliacs, and others who can't be so easily categorized. But the gay community has been hardest hit by the AIDS crisis, not just because of the numbers, but because we are a close-knit community. Our friends and lovers are dying. There has been panic and fear in our community. The government has ignored our plight, and the media has labeled AIDS a gay plague. Now, a backlash is developing among non-gays who fear we are the cause of the disease and want to legislate us back into the closet. In Los Angeles, Dr. Michael Gottlieb encountered his first AIDS patient in March of 1981, when a 33-year-old gay man was admitted to the UCLA Medical Center suffering from a severe fungal infection, high fever, and swollen lymph glands. He'd been losing weight steadily for several months and weighed barely 100 pounds. 2 weeks later, he developed a rare lung infection known as pneumocystis carinii pneumonia. Within a month, he was dead. In New York City, Dr. Alvin Friedman Kine met his first AIDS patient at about the same time, when he was asked to examine a young gay man believed to be suffering from Hodgkin's disease. Other doctors had dismissed the purple spots on the man's legs as bruises, but Friedman Kine, a dermatologist, knew better. He recognized them as lesions from a rare skin cancer, Kaposi sarcoma. In the months that followed, these doctors and others around the country saw more and more of their patients coming down with rare opportunistic infections, including pneumocystis pneumonia and Kaposi sarcoma. It was the beginning of an epidemic. In August 1981, Gottlieb and Friedman Kine published their findings. They theorized that AIDS is caused by a virus transmitted through the blood which destroys the body's natural immune response. Within a month, the Federal Center for Disease Control in Atlanta began monitoring AIDS.
During these early days of the crisis, the mainstream media generally ignored AIDS. When coverage was given, it was often distorted, outdated, or homophobic. One doctor remembers a reporter asking, "Is AIDS a problem now, or is it still just affecting gays?" ABC correspondent Geraldo Rivera explains why the media's coverage of AIDS was so shoddy.
If the identity of the original victims of this epidemic were anyone else, children or any mainstream group, I think that you would have seen news people and government people and medical and scientific people falling over each other trying to do something about it. I think that because the original victims were homosexuals, the disease had a bizarre and deadly head start.
Coverage of AIDS changed in July 1982 when doctors began reporting cases of AIDS among hemophiliacs and other non-gays. No longer ignoring the epidemic, the media now began sensationalizing it, proclaiming that the gay disease was spreading. What they didn't report was that AIDS had been seen in non-gays since the beginning. But the medical community must bear some responsibility for this. San Francisco gay activist Douglas Wright, a former medical researcher, tells why.
In the very first article that the New England Journal of Medicine published, they stated that they felt this was a homosexual disease. However, in a footnote at the end of that article, a footnote which was about that big, I found this. Since submission of the manuscript, we have documented this syndrome in two exclusively heterosexual men. The news media around the country, both heterosexual or mainstream and homosexual, it picked up on this story, did not see that footnote. And as a consequence, we had headlines like this in the San Francisco Examiner on June the 11th, 1982, homosexual male cancer spreading to heterosexuals. That is one of the most devastating and dangerous political weapons which people like the moral majority in this country have been handed on a platter in a long time, and I blame the medical profession in this country for that situation.
From the beginning, countless theories have been put forth to explain the disease. Researchers at the Center for Disease Control initially blamed poppers, amyl and butyl nitrite, for causing AIDS. Another theory placed the blame on the so-called fast lane lifestyle. Heavy drug use, combined with poppers and repeated bouts of venereal disease, were thought to be responsible for overloading the immune system. While these theories have been largely disproven, they're still receiving attention in the press, gay and non-gay. Following the outbreak of AIDS among hemophiliacs, federal health officials urged people in the high-risk groups to voluntarily refrain from donating blood. This included gays and bisexual men who had multiple sex partners. Officials feared that the nation's blood supply would become contaminated. In January 1981, the National Hemophilia Foundation urged that all gay men be prohibited from giving blood. The National Gay Task Force responded by issuing a statement calling for the screening of blood, not donors. Director Ginny Appuzzo said a policy to exclude gays would be both ineffective and inappropriate. But one Los Angeles plasma manufacturer rejected 400 gay donors in 1 month. And other blood centers asked potential donors to fill out a card to determine if they fall into any of the so-called high-risk groups. While AIDS can be transmitted through blood or by sexual contact, doctors insist that it cannot be transmitted through casual contact. Unfortunately, gays and non-gays alike remain painfully ignorant about the disease.
The threat of AIDS, as opposed to its actual state, is so widespread it's affecting the daily lives of people who will probably have no contact with it. Doctors and nurses refuse to treat AIDS patients. Cardiopulmonary resuscitation instructors refuse to share the dummies in demonstrating mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. Insurance companies refuse gay people policies. Police and fire personnel demand gas masks. Blood banks refuse blood from high-risk persons. Morticians refuse to embalm corpses of AIDS patients. Now they're talking about the 4-H Club, homosexuals, Haitians, hemophiliacs, and heroin users, who are on the route to national quarantine. Add that to the fears of the members of the 4-H Club themselves, and you have a high-stress situation that AIDS researchers warn us is aggravating to one's health and can only help the spread of AIDS. Many myths concerning AIDS contagion are for the most part untrue, but the fear of casual contact resides not only in the, quote, outside world of the heterosexual. Friends have disavowed friendships, lovers renounce lovers, people are beginning to stay home nights. Many lesbians don't concern themselves, saying it's a men's issue, and the misanthropists among them are calling it a judgment on the gay male for his promiscuity and a supposed lack of political consciousness. At the Gay Press Association convention in San Francisco in March, two lesbians stood up during a panel discussion on AIDS and protested that an hour and a half was spent discussing AIDS, while just 1 hour was spent on so-called women's issues. And probably the most insidious of all are the gay businessmen, the bathhouse owners, who make no statement, give no money, and post no warnings about the new dangers of a totally sexual environment. Has AIDS affected their business? Certainly. Randy Schiltz of the San Francisco Chronicle News Department talks about the recent bathhouse situation in San Francisco.
Bathhouse business has dropped by 50% in San Francisco in the last few months. Bathhouses are closing down. Private sex clubs are closing down. And talking to people who run gay papers here in San Francisco, I'm hearing the bathhouses are behind in their bills. For the last month, a number of political and religious leaders in the gay community were concerned about the fact that San Francisco has every year the largest gay festival in the world. Between a quarter and a half million people come here to take part in the Gay Freedom Day week stuff. And there was some concern among gay activists that these people who are coming from Visalia and Auckland, New Zealand, and other areas where there isn't a lot of AIDS information, that if they go into a bathhouse, they should get a brochure or some kind of warning saying here's what AIDS is and what specifically you can do to prevent from getting AIDS, because there's enough evidence to at least give us some direction on what to do. And so these activists were meeting privately with bathhouse owners. Bathhouse owners refused, said it was their right to, essentially said that they would decide at some future date whether or not they'd put up warnings. And so since this was going on, I got involved in it as a newspaper reporter, because it certainly is in the public interest when you've got an epidemic in the gay community of a fatal disease. It certainly is in the public interest, and I started talking to people. In the mayor, I talked to the mayor, I talked to the majority of the board of supervisors, found out that they indeed thought that there should be health warnings posted in the bathhouses.
San Francisco Supervisor Harry Britt.
My office initiated some meetings with political leaders and representatives of the bathhouse owners. Their reaction was all over the place, from one person who said that none of his customers had gotten the disease, to some others who had already gone way ahead of us in getting information out and distributing condoms and doing other things. Since that time, our health department has begun to require the distribution of AIDS information at the bathhouses, which I think is a very, very positive step. And I believe at this point we're getting real good cooperation from the people who run the baths.
Has the impact affect the bathhouses financially?
Yes, there has been some drop-off, as there has been some drop-off in the incidence of other sex-related diseases in our city. And it also has affected the way people behave when they do go to the baths. A lot of people are experimenting with ways of having sex without exchanging bodily fluids. And I think there's just a lot more care in general in the bathhouse scene. There's no question that the baths, as we have traditionally known them and as we have traditionally behaved when they go to them, are in real trouble financially if they're not able to adjust to the different kind of world we're living in now with AIDS.
But I think what they should be concerned with is not the survival of their business, but the survival of their patrons' lives.
Randy Schiltz.
And that's what I was stunned at, the early reluctance of bathhouse owners here in San Francisco. So much regard for their business that they could care less about the fact that people might die because they, so that they can make their $5 entrance fee.
One bathhouse here in L.A. is doing its best to adapt to the new environment. Without denying the sexual nature of its business, it's offering alternative amusements, not only for sex, but for the bar scene. MAX, or the Men's Action Club, is listed in the phone book, ironically, under health clubs. And it's now offering aerobics classes, it's offering parties, and it's trying to expand into some kind of community center with a more wholesome image. Yet it still offers its upstairs facilities to men, which it advertises as, quote, good clean fun. But at least they're trying. I think even bathhouse owners might think it a little hypocritical to do an AIDS benefit at a bathhouse, but we still could use the money. How about the bar scene? Harry Britt on San Francisco.
We're still partying. San Francisco is still a very good place to come to have a party. There's nothing, no reason we shouldn't party, and having a party is maybe more necessary now than it's ever been before. Everyone is looking at what gives them satisfaction and what does not. I think all of us who've come to the ghetto to get away from all the craziness of the world we were raised in tend to define pleasure and happiness in terms of a lot of things that maybe are not as satisfying as some other things. And our community in San Francisco has been moving out of the ghetto a lot and beginning to be much more rounded, well-rounded people than just a bunch of guys that go to the bars and get drunk and get laid.
So what are gay people seeking now? Are monogamous relationships coming back into vogue?
AIDS has definitely affected the way we conduct ourselves with sexually.
Harry Britt.
Everyone I know who does therapy is saying that everybody is working on their relationship that has a relationship.
People are beginning to make more permanent bonds, hoping to end the risk of contracting AIDS for good. But is this necessarily good? L.A. therapist Laud Humphreys has a word of caution.
We do things often that we later regret when we are in panic. Sometimes we end up having, you know, the sort of fight with a lover that breaks a relationship that we later regret. Or perhaps we get involved under the sorts of pressures that we think about of, wow, so people in monogamous relationships don't tend to get AIDS. We may get involved in a lot of sudden relationships that later we may regret. I was talking with some psychotherapists the other day, and I said, you know what 5 years from now we're all going to be working on? We're all going to be working on helping people break up all those hasty relationships they got into back in the years when they were fearing AIDS.
These people who make up the majority of AIDS patients, the partygoers, bathhouse patrons, also tend to be apolitical. Happy within the ghetto, they saw no threat to their innocent, idyllic lifestyle. The horrors of death and destruction they heard on television news shows were so far removed from their day-to-day pursuits, they held them as being nothing more than high drama. How has the impact of such a horrible disease affected those men still healthy? Has the message hit home?
The bad part of the reaction of the gay community, and it hasn't been everybody, but it has been a few.
Harry Britt.
Has been the denial of the reality of AIDS. This is a very, very, very serious epidemic, and people are afraid, and people should be more afraid probably than we are. And the bad reaction to me has been the desire to deny that. The denial is the tendency to pretend that this thing's going to go away.
Well, everybody's under the gun now, and if they don't realize that they're under a gun, then they're big fools.
What do I think causes it? There were some theories that said it had something to do with the actual male hormones. That actual male hormones, you know, will depress the immunity system.
Have you read up much about it?
A little.
Do you have any idea what causes it?
They still have a sexy good in your face. It's a lot of money to do that.
I think, in part, poor hygiene.
Have you heard about AIDS?
Yes, I certainly have.
And are you worried about it?
Well, I'm concerned as to why we of the gay community are creating AIDS at this particular time, because I feel that nothing happens in life unless there is a reason. So the question is, why are we doing this to ourselves?
Change my way of thinking. Make myself a different set of rules. Gonna change my way of thinking. make myself a difference instead of roof. Gonna put my good foot forward, stop being influenced by fools.
Astonishingly, some of the problems in facing the crisis are created by the leaders of the lesbian gay community.
It's startling because just about everybody knows somebody who has it.
Randy Schiltz.
And it's not a game, and I think too many gay political leaders are treating this like some little political game, and it's not a game. People are dying.
There have been people, even in our own community, who would have played down the need for education because of their fear that somehow the world's not going to like us if they find out about our lifestyle.
You know, for all those years that people have been waiting for the backlash, we still seem to be doing all right and doing nothing but gaining power. I think that they're, you know, and that I don't think it's, I think it hurts us. What's going to hurt us is if people keep on dying within our community. And that, in the, you know, there needs to be a lot of talk about AIDS. There needs to be lots of information put out there. Every gay person in, who goes into, walks into a gay bar or a gay bathhouse, or anywhere in the gay community, should immediately see, you know, be able to pick up flyers that tell them about AIDS and how it appears to be contracted. And I think that's not a, I mean, that's become a political issue up here, but I don't consider that political. I just think that's common sense.
If you spend time with the men who have this disease, as I've spent a lot of time with them, and their lives are more important, and the lives of the rest of us who may not have it yet but are very vulnerable, their lives are so much more important than any other issues on the edge of this, any fear of homophobia, any kind of unwillingness to raise the questions around this disease. We've got to make our first priority to save the lives of our gay brothers and anybody else who's going to be killed by this disease. And we cannot be afraid of the truth. Yeah, all our lives we have so much trouble dealing with all the wrong things that people believe about us. We've got not to be afraid of the truth about AIDS.
What that truth is for every gay man and every lesbian is to come out of the closet and make our collective voice overwhelm the ears of those who would pretend to ignore us. The lack of response is not only in our own community.
It took about 3 years for the federal government to do anything politically to make any kind of serious response to an epidemic. Now, if four cases of an unknown killer disease broke out in the city of Denver or the city of Philadelphia, the health apparatus of this country would be mobilized within a matter of hours. It took 3 years and hundreds of deaths before any serious response was made to this disease. And that should make us very angry, and it should make us very politically active. And in our own community, it has taken us years to begin to realize the seriousness of what is going on. I think it is absolutely urgent that every gay man who has sex know what the risks are, know what the things are that we can do that reduce the risk of the disease.
The most frustrating battle in the AIDS crisis has been the battle for funding. Money must come from the government for research to find the cause of the disease and its cure. Without adequate funding, these answers will be delayed unnecessary years. How has Washington responded? In 1982, some $2.6 million was allocated to fight AIDS. This year, after heavy lobbying efforts by gay organizations, Congress allocated $12 million to combat the epidemic. But even that small allocation is in jeopardy. New York Congressmember Ted Weiss believes President Reagan may veto the funding bill.
I don't know why the Stockman people are opposed. I suppose, you know, cynically you could take the position that what they may be doing is using what they may consider to be a controversial issue in an effort to try to justify a presidential veto of the supplemental appropriation all told, but that's the level of cynicism that I would hope that they're not guilty of.
AIDS has mobilized the gay community around the country. In April and May, demonstrations were held in most major American cities, and the White House switchboard was flooded with calls demanding more federal money for research. In New York, 6,000 people in black armbands marched down Lower Broadway in Manhattan. At a rally near the United Nations, gay activist Bob Checkey, who has AIDS, blasted President Reagan.
If you are not present at this march, and I hope somehow you will hear me. I am a man with AIDS. I'm a feeling, thinking, God-loving man with AIDS. I've always done what I could do to raise the quality of life of the people around me. Even with this illness, I continue that work. I don't always have the strength to do the job that I did before I became ill, but I do have the strength and the will and the need to pick up the phone and talk to another patient, to walk to a hospital and visit someone who is alone, afraid, and maybe dying. But the caring, the love, and the concern are not enough. Many of the people we took care of are dead. Many of the people we are taking care of now are dying. This saddens me, Mr. President, because all the love in the universe has not stopped the dying and will not bring back the dead. There is pain in my body, but I can live with this. There is pain in my heart, and that is what is so unbearable. Love helps fill the lonely hours, and love helps mend the heart, but love cannot fill the stomach, and love cannot mend the bodies. Only money can do that. The very same money over which you have influence. Like our first president, you are the father of our country. Do you hear me when I say your children are dying? This problem transcends politics. In asking you to release monies, I am asking for an act of love. If you are my father, Mr. President, I am your son. Please help me save my life.
In San Francisco, more than 10,000 gays and lesbians swarmed down Castro Street. In a rare show of solidarity, gay bars and businesses closed down for the march. And here in Los Angeles, 5,000 demonstrators rallied at the Westwood Federal Building. One of the organizers, Matt Redman, made the opening remarks to the crowd.
We are here tonight to celebrate life and living. We are here tonight to help the patients who are with us to keep on living and to protect those who are well and to keep them well. When we began plans for this march 6 weeks ago, the response from Washington to the AIDS crisis had been deplorable. The Federal Centers for Disease Control, which is responsible for surveillance and epidemiological research, claimed that the amount of money which they spent last year would suffice for this year as well. But the CDC itself predicted that there would be over 2,000 cases of AIDS this year. How can they possibly service that number of cases with the same dollar amount? And why, if they need no more funds, are they no longer able to continue surveillance activities outside of New York City, thus losing irretrievable evidence about the disease as patients die without in-depth research being done as to what caused their disease? The National Institutes of Health, which is the largest medical research organization in the world, and who on we, the American public, rely for monitoring and supporting medical research, had allocated less than 0.2% of its budget for AIDS, less than 0.2%. According to the New York Times, it had done little to mobilize biomedical researchers and had been exceedingly slow to fund the grants which had been applied for. Today, 6 weeks later, we've made some progress. You may have heard this week that the NIH approved funding of $2 million in research grants. This is a ray of hope. In Congress, due in large measure to the unceasing efforts of the California delegation, especially those of Representatives Henry Waxman, Barbara Boxer and Edward Roybal. The House of Representatives yesterday approved a $12 million supplemental appropriation for AIDS research. And today, the Senate Appropriations Committee passed that measure, and I expect that it will pass the body of the Senate within a week. And I say hallelujah, but I also say, hear us tonight, it is not enough. More needs to be done. We need to plan now for next year. We have handed out to you tonight information on how to best contact your elected representatives in Washington and what to say. Keep the pressure on Congress and let's put the screws to the Reagan administration. Undersecretary of Health and Human Services Edward Brandt has continued to say that enough has been done and is being done about AIDS. That's bullshit. It has been administration policy all along to do as little as possible, as evidenced by NIH and CDC response to date. This is a very crucial time, a time when we are just beginning to get results. This is the time to drive our point home and keep every bit of pressure that we can muster on the administration. I ask all of you here tonight to join with me in this plea. We ask, in the names of those afflicted, those who have died, those who mourn, and those who are threatened, for a crash AIDS program which would combine the nation's finest minds and provide whatever funds are necessary to support their efforts. And we pledge to continue our efforts until we have the answers which we seek and can go on about the business of living. Thank you.
Three members of the LA City Council stood together at the podium. They were enthusiastically received by the crowd. City Council President Joel Wax.
We are here tonight because people are dying in our city. And they're dying unnecessarily. And if medical researchers are correct, they're going to continue to die at increasingly greater numbers unless we are prepared to do something about it. This city and this country is facing an incredibly grave crisis. And it is up to each man, woman, and child, straight or gay, irrespective of anyone's social, ethnic, or political persuasion, to join in the united effort to stop this dreaded disease.
Council Member Pat Russell.
I'm with you tonight to applaud the efforts of our Congressman Ed Roybal and Henry Waxman, who have led not only our state delegation, but the entire United States Congress in getting some appropriations made for this dread disease. What we want to say to them is thank you, and to the rest of the Congress and to the administration, we say you've got to get moving. We need more, and we need it faster.
And Councilmember Zev Yaroslavsky.
I join with the many thousands of people. This is quite a sight from this vantage point. And the point is being well made. It's amazing that it has taken so long for AIDS to get on the nation's health agenda. And standing here in the shadows of the federal building, I say to the President of the United States and the Secretary of Health and Human Services, I certainly hope that the cure for this disease, this dread disease, is not held hostage to the idiosyncrasies of some of the people who make the decisions and the positions of power in this country.
The man responsible for the rally, Daniel Warner, made an impassioned call for action.
Tonight, we are marching as are others across America, and we shouldn't have to be. Tonight, we are pleading for our lives and the future lives of Americans, and we should not have to be. We are, however, living in a time where tonight, people from all walks of life, from every aspect of society, have gathered here tonight for a common cause. Not just from one community, but from many, and that should always be. We are here to demand the rights of Americans, the right of life and respect for that life. After all, we are the spirit of this country, and right now, our spirit is not sitting still.
Bill Bader spoke of the pain of having AIDS and told of his optimism for the future.
I was diagnosed with AIDS last December. First of all, I'd like to say thanks for any of you in the audience who might be thinking, gee, he looks pretty good for having AIDS. But what I really wanted to say in coming here tonight is a thank you on behalf of all the patients in the country, everywhere, who have AIDS. The worst part of having this disease for myself, and I think this is true for most other AIDS patients, is not the physical hassles. They're bad. But the worst part is the sense of isolation and the incredible loneliness and the times of indescribable hopelessness in combating this disease. But as I look out tonight and in talking to people before, all I felt was a sense of faith and hope and a lot of love coming from all you people. And right now, I don't feel any sense of isolation or loneliness, and I don't feel any sense of hopelessness. And it's this kind of concern, the kind that's brought you people here tonight, that makes me able to stand here and say, I know I'm going to win over this disease.
People with AIDS are often stigmatized by friends and family. Bobby Campbell, who was diagnosed with AIDS 2 years ago, explains.
The BAR ran a story on a friend of mine who, the headline read, Coalition Treasurer KS Victim. And my friend, who was the subject of this interview, was very unhappy because the implication of KS Victim means the bus has run over you. And you're laying there in the street, flattened, and he's very much alive. So am I. I do not feel like a victim. There is no simple categorization of those of us who have this ailment. And the idea that something could be spreading to the heterosexual community is really frightening. I think the implication of that is that there is a gay virus, that anyone at this table could suddenly keel over because I'm sitting here. I know that there are some horror stories about people with AIDS who have been disenfranchised of their basic rights. Their roommates have kicked them out. They've been served on paper plates, that bar tenders refuse to serve them drinks, that their lovers have kicked them out, that their families have disowned them is horrifying. And I think this is an extreme example of what's going on. I've been very fortunate in that I've had a tremendous amount of support around my illness and what I needed people to do for me. But at the same time, it's important to realize that not all of us have been that fortunate.
Bobby is a writer and registered nurse who's had AIDS for 2 years. He addressed the Gay Press Association convention in San Francisco in March.
I'd like to tell you just a little bit about my story. I'm a nurse and a graduate student at the University of California at San Francisco. I'm earning a master's degree as a nurse practitioner with a focus in the healthcare of gay men. So that when I heard about these AIDS diseases, it was right up my alley. Unfortunately, I was in the alley at the time when the truck came through. I had shingles, herpes zoster, in February of 1981, which is very unusual for a man who at that time was 29. I was hospitalized and put on steroids, which in hindsight might have been a big mistake because steroids have the effect of reducing one's immunity. But it made me feel better, so I didn't question at that time, or neither did my doctors. Later that summer, I had a distorted blood picture. I didn't have enough white blood cells as a result of just a casual blood test that they did. So I was off work again because if I don't have enough white blood cells, I can't work as a nurse. Even on an orthopedic floor, broken bones, there are enough bugs running around that I didn't want to expose myself. Then in September, I noticed these spots on my feet that looked like blood blisters, and they didn't go, and I'd just been hiking, so I didn't pay any attention to them. But a few weeks later, they were still there. The KS story was raging in the Chronicle and the Examiner, and so I went in to have a biopsy with Mark Conant, and in fact the results came back that I did have captured sarcoma, so I was plunged into this whole story that has led me to be here today. My reaction to that was, I was stricken. I mean, it was a horrible experience to hear that I had cancer, that I had this disease that was potentially fatal, and at the same time I felt okay physically, and I still do, I feel great. But I spoke to a good friend of mine, Randy Alfred, who at that time was the editor of The Sentinel, and Randy encouraged me to write for The Sentinel and to kind of demystify, as Constantine put it, the AIDS story. So I went through my whole experience of being diagnosed, being worked up, being treated, coming out to my parents as having cancer. They already knew I was a faggot, and was able to translate the story into the readership so that to use terms, one of the things that I had to do was to demystify again, to use terms that people may not understand, syndrome or lesions or whatever. I know perfectly well what that means, but the casual reader may not, so I had to spend a lot of effort in translating this kind of stuff into something that anybody picking up the paper would understand what it was. Doug spoke earlier about enhancing people's personal careers, and I, in a way, was enhancing my personal patient career in that by being able to be out there as an upfront KS or AIDS patient, I got a tremendous amount of personal support. Now, I don't think that that was necessarily selfish in a bad way. It gained me a lot of help at a time when I needed it. And at that time, I was essentially the only patient who was out there. And I believe, to my knowledge, that I'm the only patient who has written extensively about my experience. There have been some other patients who have been interviewed in other print and other media. So that I feel like both in terms of being a nurse and as being an out there patient with AIDS, that I'm in kind of a special relationship in terms of this disease. I think that what each of us as professional journalists need to do is to help make this disease complex real for people who are not in this special relationship, who are not nurses, and who may not be identified AIDS patients, but who are concerned about it for one reason or the other. That certainly is what I am viewing as my personal mission, is to try and make the AIDS process real for people who have not been to nursing school and who do not at this time have been through the colonoscopy and the CAT scan and the phone call to mom, hoping that may help them from going through that, because it's been a horrifying 2 years, you know. For all that I can be glad that I've survived this long, for all of the incredible experiences that I've had being here right now, I mean, I would not wish this on anyone else. I feel very fortunate in that I feel very healthy. I feel, occasionally I have sores in my mouth, which may very well be the result of the chemotherapy. Doug spoke earlier about the treatment that is used for Kaposi's sarcoma is very debilitating sometimes. I've been fortunate in that I have not had my hair fall out or become nauseated or so forth, but I do sometimes have relatively minor side effects. For me, it's such a sores in the mouth. I think for me the biggest problem that I face is depression. I mean, this is really a downer to have to deal with this syndrome, to pick up the BAR or our paper or anything that I pick up will have something on AIDS every issue. This has become the topic of 1982, 1983. And sometimes the coverage that I see in the gay media is very sensationalistic, and it makes me unhappy. Because I think that what I would like to address on this panel is the particular perspective I have is one of us that's in this particular boat right now. The thing that I complain about the most, I think, is that sensationalistic headlines have been used to sell papers or to sell advertising space or whatever that do not accurately reflect the body of the work that's being done, or else the actual story itself plays up the most outrageous aspects possible in order to sell it to the people in the Sunset or the people wherever. By way of example, I think that I've done a number of interviews for various media, and I always start out by saying the only ground rule I have is that I'm not going to talk about my past sex and drug history, because if my graduate advisor, the dean of the graduate division, reads this paper, they're going to have a heart attack. And I'm not concerned that Dean Korloff is actually going to pick up the BAR and say, my God, he did paupers for 12 years, you know, so much as I am, that this is going to be made into the focus of the article, because I've seen that happen to a number of people, and I think that there is much more importance in a number of other things that are happening without focusing on the real outrageousness. But this can be played up, I think, in ways that make it real for people by separating it out. It's like over there. It couldn't happen to me because it happens to these people, the sex-crazed alcoholic drug abusers, but not me, surely. Douglas spoke earlier about enhancing personal careers, that a number of docs, the joke that I have is that people are ready to buy their plane ticket to Stockholm to receive their Nobel Prize in medicine. And I don't care if my doctor gets in the cover of Time magazine or gets the Nobel Peace Prize to go to Stockholm, as long as he can seriously do something to help me and to help my brothers and sisters that have this ailment. I think that it's okay for people to look at this from a personal perspective as well, because we each get something out of every experience that we're in. But to do that exclusively, I do not want someone to go to Stockholm over my dead body, literally. And I think that it's important for us to realize that there is a human component to this ailment. It is not simply a headline, and it is not simply something that sells advertising space. There are people that are suffering. And I am. And I think that we need to look at that as well. I think that you shouldn't just look at that side, because then it becomes maudlin. And I've seen some responses in the gay press, especially out of New York. New York is crazy, people. I can't believe what I read in the New York Native and in other periodicals in which everything is printed. And I think that that has its argument, that you can say, well, you know, this way you get a number of different perspectives. Some people have written things that make me cringe, and that includes people who have AIDS, who are certain, absolutely certain, that promiscuity is the cause of this ailment. The only solution to this is for people to become monogamous, and if you do not agree with that, you are lying to yourself and to us, and you are no friend of ours. I can't believe that. And I think that that kind of position is coming from a heavy, heavy guilt-ridden perspective, that these people said, you know, we spent 13 years on the circuit and we know that we are guilty people, and by implication you are too. Ooh, gives me the creeps.
Robert Bland is reluctant to tell people he has AIDS,
I haven't told too many people, partly because the phone starts ringing. And you spend sometimes 2 or 3 hours explaining to people how well you really are, rather than how sick, or and they're all worried about whether or not you're going to die instantly.
Robert edits the newsletter of the Lesbian and Gay Rights chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union. He talked about living with AIDS in an interview last month.
When I asked my doctor what my mortality would be, he didn't have an answer. And so now I've gone on for quite a few months. And I expect that once the Kaposi's is licked, I'll still have AIDS, which is an extraordinary vulnerability to disease. I think most of the side effects are under control. Well, not being active at all and not being able to do anything about the disease or the insurance and not being able to go anywhere at all is more depressing than anything else.
So this must have been a big change for you in your life, going from being very sexually active to all of a sudden sex has become very taboo, I guess, for you.
I used to work on a statistical principle almost of, let's see, 1,000 contacts this year and 1,000 last year. I must be the sexual prima donna of New York City. And I was quite well known in the streets and in the baths, all over the city. Life now is, it's comparatively Dollsville. As the doctor told me, you don't have to treat yourself like a leper, but there isn't much else you can do except with this one fellow who's my teddy bear buddy.
So now you're into heavy cuddling?
Heavy cuddling, literally.
But despite incredible obstacles, people with AIDS are determined to live. As one AIDS patient put it, we're not victims, we're fighters.
For those of you who feel helpless in the face of this most terrifying of crises, take heart. The answer is clear. Take responsibility for the lives of your sisters and brothers. We're not talking anymore of the right to love, but the chance to live.
There's no happy ending for this program tonight, because there's no happy ending for the people who have AIDS. There are no eulogies because there's not time. The fight is not over. It's just beginning. So light a light and get to work. It's going to be a long night. But we will survive, you and I, if we fight together for our lives. For IMRU,
this has been David Fracken
and David Hunt.